Are you still living in Princeton?
No, I live out in Hampton. I came to hate Princeton.
It's in New Jersey.
Well, that's part of it.
The broadcast, incidentally, is also kind of on regular radios. You can pick it up places other than the cars.
Well, that's why I listen to the radio all the time in the car. So I drive a lot and
weekends?
I live out there all week. Uh-huh. So, you know, I turn on 880 and...
Yeah. Well, weekends, it's heard 5 times over the weekend, and during the Monday through Friday period, it's heard in about 1:50 in the afternoon.
Well, it's easy when I'm up there. Yeah. I'm going to get the newspaper.
I like the book a lot, and it reminded me of... it was such a personal memoir that it reminded me somewhat of the book that Willie Morris wrote about James Jones, mm-hmm. The Friendship. Did you read that?
Yeah, but I don't think the book's as lugubrious as...
No, it's not nearly as personal. It's,
I mean, when when Jones died, I mean, Willie went absolutely nuts. And then the night of his death, he went out in Bridgehampton about 3 o'clock in the morning, stopped all the traffic on Montauk Highway, screaming and yelling, running around. You know, but then he's a terrible drunk at that point, I mean, Willie. He's a wonderful writer, but... He had a real fixation on Jones.
Well, he had been working with James Jones toward the end on that last book called Whistle.
Yeah.
And if you read that book, you'll see that the last few chapters of the book are very short because they were almost outlines.
Yeah.
And Willie just kind of patched it together. I was out at Bobby Vann's. I'd made a deliberate point of stopping at Bobby Vann's this past summer because I wanted to. I'd never been there before, but I wanted to go in. I knew they had the photograph of John Knowles and James Jones and see who else is there. Willie and one other person. Anyway, I wanted to pay my last respects.
Oh, that's nice.
In effect, because Truman Capote had just died. Oh. And now his picture was, did I mention Capote?
Capote's no, you said no.
Was there too, so I wanted to stop in.
Well, he wanted to die, Truman.
Pardon me?
He wanted to die, Truman. I mean, he tried very hard over 10 years and finally succeeded.
To die?
Yeah. I mean, Tennessee didn't want to die and died accidentally. Truman deliberately wanted to die.
I don't know. It looked to me as though Tennessee Williams, the way you have described it here, really tormented his life with all sorts of drugs and alcohol on a very consistent and all, it seemed almost suicidal.
Well, except Mr. Swain, Don, Tennessee never used recreational drugs. Didn't smoke grass. I know the coroner said there was cocaine. He never used cocaine. He couldn't because he had heart disease and high blood pressure, and if he'd used it, he would have had a stroke. Every drug that Tennessee used was prescribed for him. Doctors gave it to him. Doctors told him he was depressed. We'll take amphetamine. When he couldn't sleep, take Seconal. I mean, he never bought an illegal drug in his life that I know of.
But
he always got it from a doctor.
But you point out in this book that he would go to towns, go to several doctors and put prescriptions together.
There.
And you yourself would get a prescription for him.
Sure.
So that he could pile up these drugs. So it was almost the same thing.
No, but Tennessee wouldn't wake up in the morning and say, I want to get high today. He wouldn't use drugs in order to get a buzz on, in order to flip out. He'd use drugs, to sleep. His Tennessee was in a lot of pain. He used drugs to sleep, but also he went to Dr. Feelgood and was put on the shots. At that time, amphetamine was perfectly legal. It wasn't even a controlled substance, and it was given for languor and for people on a diet.
No one
knew the dangers of it.
But didn't you say that Tennessee would often wake up in the morning and make a cup of coffee or, mm-hmm. or something and a martini at the same mm-hmm. time?
Oh, always. He had the same that lived all the life, all the time I knew him. All the times I lived with him, he had the same regimen. He'd get up early, and he'd toddle off into the kitchen if this is Key West, and he'd make himself a martini and a pot of coffee, and I'd make him a martini, and I'd be on my way to bed, and we'd have a drink together, and then he'd take his coffee and a bottle of red wine in the studio, and then disappear for 4 hours, 5 hours of work. But he needed the Tennessee needed the, which I do, he needed the liquor in order to lower inhibitions. And he wouldn't, Tennessee never wrote when he was drunk, but he would have one martini, and he'd have a couple glasses of wine while he wrote. When he rewrote, he was sober. When he did the first writing, during the creative writing, Tennessee would always have a couple drinks. But when in the afternoon, he'd sit down after lunch, and he'd take a nap, and he'd get up, and usually around 6, he'd disappear for an hour, and he'd be sober, and that's when he would do his rewriting. That's when he'd edit what he'd written, getting ready for the next morning.
That's kind of interesting. A lot of people say you cannot write when you drink, but Styron told me that he thinks that drinking has helped him in the creative process. But I wonder if he did what Williams did, revises sober. I just don't see how people can execute a finished product.
I don't know an American writer who's not a drunk. I don't know one. And I've kind of the pressures on American writers, the kind of pressures Tennessee was under. You need to relax. You have to do something to deal with the tension and the stress. That's why Tennessee needed Valium. And when he was in particularly need of drugs was not when he was working it, but it was when he was facing the production of a play. You go into rehearsals, you come home and notes, you got to sit up and make rewrites. You're dealing with a lot of crazy actors, producers and the money people. And it would drive any sane person nuts. But I don't think that, it was his use of drugs or his drinking that affected his writing. I don't think people say, well, that's why his writing at the end was not up to snuff. I don't think that's true at all.
Dr. Rader, let's go back. How did you meet Tennessee Williams?
Well, I write about it in the book. I mean, it's kind of funny. I went to I met him in 69. I thought he was, I hadn't heard anything about him, and I didn't know he'd been in a loony bin, and he just disappeared. And I knew a number of people who knew him, because people had talked about him and told stories about him, and I admired him, but I just assumed he was dead. And I went to this opening of this porno movie, which is a real sort of social event down in Soho. And then I went on to the party after. And I used to wear a black cowboy hat and leather jacket and boots and stuff then. And I came to this party, and Candy Darling, who was a drag queen, superstar of Warhols, was there. And she came up to me, rather brusque, and said, Tennessee Williams here and wants to meet you. And I said, well, Tennessee's dead, isn't he? And she said, now he's my date and he wants to meet you. She was very jealous. And I met Tennessee, and he asked me, he'd read some of my stuff, and he asked me how much I charged to spend a night with a gentleman. And I said, $100, $200, something like that. And he sort of rolled his eyes. Then he said, well, what would I charge to accompany a gentleman to dinner? And I said, $50. And then he rolled his eyes, and he said, well, what about lunch, baby? And then I saw him for lunch the next day at the Plaza Hotel, and that's how we became friends.
Tennessee Williams' homosexuality. Mm-hmm. You made this clear throughout the book that he was a decided member of the homosexual community.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he complained to you that once his homosexuality became known, I think it was Time Magazine did an article or something on it, that all of a sudden he had difficulty in producing his plays.
That's right.
Well, tell me how you see his homosexuality as having an impact on him as an artist.
Well, in The Cry of the Heart, the book, he talks about the fact that doesn't think he could have been a writer if he hadn't been gay. It's simply on a matter of lifestyle, because it wasn't until he was 36 years old that he had his first success. And, he supported himself with menial jobs and running elevators and that sort of thing. And if he had had a wife and a family to support, he never would have had the time to write. That's number one. Number two, we were once talking about why was it that it's so hard to think of a major American playwright or poet or novelist who isn't either gay or Jewish or both. And that's the tendency gave me that line of Hart Crane's, as a world dimensional for those untwisted by the love of things irreconcilable. Crane himself was gay. And Tennessee grew up in a world in which literally to be homosexual was to be an outlaw. in which not only did this, it's the only group of citizens this has ever happened to after the emancipation, in which to be homosexual by nature was to be criminal. So one, it produced a furtiveness among homosexuals to protect themselves from going to jail. Like in Mississippi today, you can get 35 years to life for a single act of sodomy, whether it's consensual adults or not. And so he grew up with this, knowing both the cultural disapproval, the moral disapproval, in terms of the commanding culture, and also in terms of the illegality of it. And he knew lots of friends had been arrested, and homosexuals could be beaten up at will, and it would be the gay that the police would arrest. So he grew up in an age of fierce homophobic feeling in this country. And what that produced in him, which is where his greatness came from, was an extraordinary sense of outsidedness. And I think why Jews and why gays, not only in this country, but in all the Western countries, are so prolific in terms, I mean, they to an enormous degree create high art in the West. I mean, our films, our books, our interior design, the clothes we wear. And so you have this hated minority which interprets to the majority the nature of the culture. And it's the sense of being outside. In other words, he tends to grow up with two realities. One, the very thing he was, which was gay, the very center of his being, was defined by his own country as immoral and criminal. So it could only be admitted through metaphor, through analog, through plays. He grew up in a world that was hostile, so he was forced to move into art and to create an entire world in which he was comfortable in which he was accepted. And the happiest period of his life were the first 8 years of his life when he was a little boy in Mississippi. It's the only happy, consistently happy time. And so he took those fragments of memory about growing up in Mississippi, and he used them for the rest of his life and recreated the South. He invented the South. And his invention is so powerful that from now until the end of history, people will not be able to look at the American South except through his eyes.
That's the way to quote Tennessee Williams as saying that had he had a family, a wife, children, he'd be so busy trying to provide for them he could never have been the artist that he was. But you make it clear that he seemed to spend a good portion of his time cruising, looking for one-night stands, looking for hustlers, going in and out of affairs, falling, breaking affairs, and the trauma involved. It seemed to me that he worked harder at being a homosexual than he might have been had he not been a homosexual.
No, I don't think he worked harder at being one. I think I think from the time Time magazine blew his cover, he never gave a damn anymore what anyone thought. So he just acted himself. He had absolutely no moral scruples about prostitution. He liked prostitutes. By the time I met him, which is 14 years before he died, to a large degree his career was in decline, and all the people who had made their careers on his work, Beatty, Brando, Elizabeth Taylor, and so on, had abandoned him because he was of no use to them anymore. He couldn't produce another streetcar, so they didn't need him. And so as he got older, he had less and less friends. He was less and less received. And like all of us, he had a deep need for human affection. He understood what people thought of him. He was no dummy. He knew why Warren Beatty wouldn't return phone calls. He knew why at the end producers and directors wouldn't return phone calls. He was not a dummy. He was aware of it. And he could find comfort. Tennessee cruised not so much for sex as for companionship.
Did you have a sexual relationship with Tennessee Williams?
No. I mean, just to regard to the boys, I mean, I think we went through hundreds of them in the time we were together. And never once did any one of these young men ever steal from Tennessee. They never hit him. They never abused him. They were kind. He brought out kindness in people. But we'd go to a dinner party at someone else's house, and he'd drag some kid along. And the kid would go into over the host and clean out his medicine cabinet or clean out his jewelry box. I mean, that happened a lot, but they never touched Tennessee.
You have a wonderful anecdote, if you can recall it. It was the time in Key West that you and Tennessee were attacked on the street by five thugs, and Tennessee had a wonderful rejoinder. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, well, we were walking. We were a little tipsy, and we had gone out to dinner, and we were walking back down to Vol, which is the main drag in every sense of the term, Key West, to the taxi stand to get a taxi home. And we saw these five young men sitting on this concrete planter. And Tennessee and I were singing hymns, because my family's Southern, he was Southern. And we'd get drunk, we'd tend to burst into Southern hymns. And we were singing I Come to the Garden Alone, and Tennessee spotted these five guys, went up and said, "Oh, baby," to one of the guys, "we're itinerant choristers trying to make an honest buck. Would you care to hear a chorus?" And we burst into song. And I thought we sang pretty good. And the guys got up and surrounded us. And the big one in front had a knife. And I saw the knife, and I pulled Tennessee back. I said, "Let's get the hell out of here." And he pulled his arm away. He was looking at me like I was the withering coward. And he said to the big bruiser, "My name is Tennessee Williams, and I'll remember you tomorrow." Whereupon this kid tried to kick him in the face, and I pulled him back. And I said, "Tennessee, let's get out of here." And he looked at me and looked at the kids, and he said, "My name is Tennessee Williams, and I am not in the habit of retreat." Whereupon they hit me and picked him up and threw him on top of me and started kicking him. And later, when I asked him, I said to him, "Who the hell were those kids who mugged us?" And he said, "Oh, baby, they're probably New York drama critics."
Probably were. I was in New Orleans a couple of years ago, and we decided to take one of these carriage rides. And our guide was a rather illiterate man who was driving the horse, and he was pointing out spots and tourist attractions and this sort of thing. He said, "Over there is where Tennessee Ernie wrote Streetcar Named Desire." And I said, "Williams." He said, "What?" I said, "Williams." He said, "Who's Williams?" You've been telling tourists that for years, and nobody ever corrected it.
Well, listen, nothing on back to Street Boys.
Yeah.
One of the things I think about them that he appreciated is they never knew who he was, so he could trust their affection. They were never trying to say, "Well, can you give me a part? Can I do a reading for you?" They never hustled him in that way. And so because they never knew who he was, he could trust their affection and their company.
Along with that, you tell the story of forging a $600 check.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, he'd had a, I forget the name the lawyers used for him in the book, young man from raised horses in Topanga Canyon. It was terrible.
All the names of the men that he picked
most
up that
them.
You describe are made up, I would assume.
Well, most of them are. Some aren't.
Mm.
I mean, I did. The lawyers did that. I hate lawyers. And so this fellow, young man, about 26, was remarkably kind, sweet, handsome fellow. Came and stayed, was with Tennessee for 3-4 months. And he wanted to ride, and they ended up going out to Montauk and to his ranch, and it poured every day. And there was no hot food. Tennessee was miserable. But he was so fond of this kid that he would go out, and Tennessee did not know how to ride, and on his horse every day. And after a while, he got hemorrhoids. And he could barely walk, and he came back and checked into, I think it was New York Hospital, Lenox Hill, and have them removed, and got out about a week later and was in agony. And of course he blamed this guy. And so one night I got a call at the Dakota where I lived, and from the fellow saying that Tennessee had passed out and he was going to leave for California. This is about 2:33 in the morning, and he was afraid to leave Tennessee alone. Could I come and stay with him? I said, "Don't move, I'll be right there." So I got over to the LSA. And Tennessee was indeed out. He was playing dead in the bedroom, which was his ploy of first resort. And the kid had a backpack. And I said, "Where the hell are you going? It's pouring out. The airport's closed." He said, "Well, I'm going to hitchhike back." And I knew Tennessee, then I just knew Tennessee was playing dead, so he wouldn't have to give him airfare. Because they really didn't want the kid to leave. And I just made me furious. So I went in the bedroom and started shaking, and I shook him hard to wake him up, and he rolled his eyes and groaned and pretended he was dead. So I still haven't forged his name. I just went over and I said, shouted, I'm giving money. And I forged a check for $600, took it down to the desk and cashed it and gave the kid the money. But Tennessee couldn't deal, Tennessee had a terrible time dealing with crisis, particularly domestic crisis.
When Tennessee called for a priest once, didn't you actually call for Bishop Moore?
Yeah, Bishop Moore came.
Right? Can't go much higher than that. Well, you go a little higher.
The priest I knew.
You have long stretches of quotations in here from mm-hmm. Tennessee. Did you tape him, or how did you reconstruct the style?
I have lots of it is from tapes. We did a lot of tapes together. And then the rest is from journals that I kept. And I mean, half the book is Tennessee talking about his friends and gossiping in his life. But I see, I think where I did the book, I think there's like 11 books in the works now on Tennessee. And except for myself, no one writing about Tennessee ever met him. And I was his best friend, and I lived with him, and I knew the man. And I knew when he died that his work would live. As long as our language is spoken, Tennessee's work will live. But already in the obituaries, after death, the whole mythology was starting. They were draining the blood from the man. He said homosexuality wasn't mentioned anymore. The whole cleaning up of a national icon. It's just like with Walt Whitman. High school kids read Walt Whitman, or they read Hawthorne, or they read Melville. And they're never told that these were homosexual writers. They study Socrates, and they're never told he was gay. It's that same process is happening with Tennessee, because this country will not allow gay youngsters to have a role model. Now, let me finish the point.
Okay.
So I thought this man's work was extraordinary, but I thought his life was even more extraordinary. He's the most extraordinary human being I ever met. And I thought, if I don't write it, if I don't say what it was, this man was like, his laughter and his sense of humor and his kindness and his meanness and his tantrums, the man's life will be lost. And it'll also be lost to me, because in time my memory will go. So I wrote it in order to, so I wouldn't have to let him go.
Just, I think you make reference to the fact that you looked upon Tennessee Williams as a surrogate father. Mm-hmm. Sarah, can you explain that?
Well, I was never close to my father. My father's a fundamentalist evangelist. You know, Jerry Falwell sort of thing. And I was never close to him. And Tennessee was never close to his father. And so Tennessee very quickly, I mean, within days of, he became a father figure to me. But on the other hand, Tennessee was very childlike and very spoiled and could be very naughty and very dependent. And so in a funny way, I played a parenting role to him. Because, you know, a lot of things Tennessee didn't like to do, he had to do. And so you had to make him do it. I mean, like an interview. Some guy, poor soul, would fly down to Key West for an interview, and Tennessee would be locked in his studio claiming he's having a heart attack, or he'd hide in the closet and saying he wasn't home. But it always astonished me, because he'd be locked in the bedroom, and I'd knock on the door, and I'd say, so-and-so's here. And he'd say, his voice would ring out, tell him I'm dead, or I've just had a heart attack. And then you'd have to go in, and you'd have to get him to do it, and then he would pout and be sullen and sulk for hours. But, you know, to get him to eat what he was supposed to eat, to get him to take his pills that he was supposed to take. I mean, I'm talking about his heart and all that stuff. So on one hand, he was very much like a child. He was very dependent. Tennessee couldn't function by himself. And as he got older, you don't become like a nurse. But on the other hand, I needed his strength. And he taught me a great deal, and not only most taught me, he taught me what to avoid his fate. I'm not talking about as a writer, I mean as a man.
In what regard? Not that I couldn't guess, but I mean, it was, you could spell that out.
The abuse of drugs, in terms of Tennessee, I don't know, I can't use the term on the air, Tennessee had an inability finally to let go. To say, screw it. He couldn't let a play go. He couldn't let a bad director go. He couldn't let anything go. Because he was an optimist, finally was an optimist, against all evidence to the contrary. And his will was so strong, he refused to admit that he'd lost a project and go on to something else. That's what would produce these tantrums, this terrible, terrible frustration of being unable to get his way, unable to see the work, his vision presented as he wrote it. So what happened is, if you look all the way to plays, the first drafts, second drafts are invariably wonderful. And then each additional draft gets worse and worse and worse as his self-confidence gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and as he has directors bad-mouthing him and money people bad-mouthing him and stars throwing tantrums, and he's changing and changing and changing. And so gradually his own vision recedes, and what you have is a work produced by a committee. And that's why particularly the New York productions were so lousy.
Dodson, just to go back to something you said before, you described him as a homosexual writer, but I wonder if that is accurate.
No, I don't say he's a homosexual. He's a homosexual who also was a writer.
Right.
I don't think there is such a thing as a homosexual writer. I think the same thing. I think there's a homosexual imagination, but I don't think there's such a thing as a homosexual writer per se.
Well, I think there's little doubt that Tennessee Williams has left us a legacy that is going to go on for many, many years. People say he's the second greatest playwright next to Eugene O'Neill. I don't know. There are times I feel that O'Neill is not holding up very well.
O'Neill is so dated. Except for Long Day's Journey and the Night, everyone who's plays are dated. Tennessee's work has not dated.
In the 1950s, I used to think that Maxwell Anderson was the greatest playwright. I happened to see a television version of Winterset not too long ago. And it's roughly based on Sacco Vanzetti, and it takes place on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the 30s. And the difference between the good people who were the workers and the Wall Street capitalists who were the evil people was so clear cut. I mean, it just didn't hold up. And yet I thought that the speech was so gorgeous when Anderson wrote it, and perhaps it's still beautiful poetry. But it just doesn't work. But somehow, William's stuff, up to this point at least, even the early things he did in the late 40s, mid-40s, they're still with us. They're going to last for a long time. I think I'm glad that you wrote this, because this is a personal story and about a personal relationship and about a man we need to know more about. And I'm glad you wrote that, and I thank you very much for coming in and spending this half hour with me.
Thank you.